You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hello, and welcome back to Lovecraft Country Critical.
Yay! Woo!
I am joined by some currently disembodied and unnamed voices. Gaz, down under.
Hello.
Lucy.
Hello.
Len, also down under.
Yes. Hello.
I am Emma, your host, as usual. Welcome back. If this is the first time that you're tuning in, welcome. Welcome to the show. There are four other episodes that you could have listened to first, but if this is how you like to work, crack on. Today we're going to be talking about episode 5 of Lovecraft Country.
Why are you slagging them off?
I'm not slagging them off.
Unbelievable.
You know, if you want to do things differently, that's totally fine, but go back and listen to them.
Yeah. Do you?
One star, not welcoming to new listeners.
We are going to talk about episode 5 today, which is titled Strange Case. As always, we will talk about our overall thoughts of the episode, give it a blueberry score, then deep dive into the plot, before we head over to Cthulhu Corner and listener feedback. So let's just get straight into it. Gaz, I'm going to come to you first. What did you think of this episode? What is your blueberry score? And how does that blueberry scale work?
Okay, so blueberry scale, first of all, I'll kick off with that. It is a simple yet complex beast. It's 0 to 5 blueberries, how we rate all of our medium. We don't watch Medium. That's a series coming soon, I'm sure.
Oh my God, imagine if we did that.
Hey, look, I mean, TV's slow at the moment. Who knows?
It is.
We'll do that. And Charmed and
Supernatural.
Supernatural. Complete the trio. anyway, 0 to 5. 5 being wonderful and 0 being shit. And you can't have half a blueberry. That is critical. Hence the name Fan Critical. It's not really where we get the name. This series so far for me has been uneven in its blueberry reception. It got 5 blueberries for episode 1, followed by 3, followed by 5. I wasn't here last week, but I'll tell you that I gave it a 3. So, will I follow the pattern? Will the pattern be followed? Just, you know, building a bit of tension.
Yeah, the listeners have a chalkboard and they've got all of our scores with little asterisks and they're correlating the, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, a red string.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm sure that they're awaiting at chalkboard with bated breath.
Yeah, get ready.
Well, I can tell you the pattern has been broken.
Oh, shit.
For better or for worse.
It's going to be a 4.
Well, it can't be better because it's not, because it would have been 5 blueberries. You weren't listening to the explanation.
Listen to the explanation of the scale, please. Every episode.
Remember, do the explanation again, Gaz. Do it again. No, don't.
Okay. So It looks like it was in line. It looked like it was in line for another five bloobs, but sadly not.
Oh, yeah.
I thought the episode was pretty uneven, sort of narratively speaking, and which was in complete contrast to last week, which I thought was actually quite well held together in terms of narrative through lines. But whereas like last week was sort of a bizarre episode of The Goonies, this was a horrific episode of Saw at times. Like the grotesque horror was, oh my word.
Awesome.
Yeah. It was hard to watch at times though, wasn't it?
No.
Well,
brilliant.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Yes, I think
it was. I'm with you guys, yeah.
Because we're not all psychopaths here. And new hairstyle and facial hair suggests that you might be, Len.
Yeah, it's fair.
Yeah.
Lockdown.
I did comment on that, yeah.
Yeah, God.
Moustache and headband, I've lost it. I've lost it in lockdown.
Absolutely lost it. Not enough hair to wear a headband.
Gaz, what is your blueberry score?
It's three blueberries, Jesus. Lucy.
We're going off track there.
I think, you know, the sort of Jekyll and Hyde part of the story is, you know, a strange case.
Did you say Gekyll and Hyde?
No.
Gecko.
No, I didn't.
Gecko and Hyde.
Gecko and Hyde.
Gecko and Hyde.
Gecko and I. Part of the story was the best bit, probably the tightest packed. And but yeah, other bits like Montrose's story. We need to resolve the death of Yahima before I care about Montrose, I think. Yeah, so three blueberries.
Thanks, Gaz. I'm going to go next, actually, just for funsies.
Treat yourself.
Not really, I'm the host, so do what you like. I'm with Gaz here. I felt that this episode was really mixed. Like, some parts of it I really enjoyed and felt distinctly uncomfortable with, mostly Ruby's storyline here. And some of it was surprising to me because, you know, spoiler warning for Cthulhu Corner, doesn't quite match up with the book, but interesting, very interesting. And I kind of liked the gory, grossy stuff. But other parts of it just really fell flat for me, like seriously flat. And like Montrose's storyline, there was so much stuff in there that I wanted to unpack. And it just felt like it was a bit part that didn't matter. And I think that was doing him a disservice because he's a really interesting character. So I kind of ummed and ahed about this quite a lot. But I agree with Gaz that this is a three bloob for me.
Why am I in such disagreement with the Montrose
stuff? You're
going
to have to wait. You're going to have to wait, Len.
Yeah, I will.
Not your turn. I'm waiting. Last and least. Lucy next.
No, go on, Len. You can go next. Thing. Uh-huh. Chomping at the bit.
Yeah, I love the Montrose stuff. I actually, as much as I agree, and you know my thoughts from last week, that the Yahima thing was a complete misstep from the show and a stupid moment for the Montrose character. And yes, I don't excuse him for anything that he did, and just because he had a couple of moments this week, which I think humanizes character more, I don't forgive him for that act. But I do think that ballroom scene, fuck me, yeah. I love that scene.
That
so
was
much.
Good.
It's a good scene.
That was good.
That for me was the show at its best. I don't know what it was about it. It's just that was a good marrying of music, cinematography, character development. And it was beautiful, and I absolutely loved that scene. And I think it humanized Montrose in a way that makes him more understandable. And his storyline this week, I think, does shed some light on why he does the things that he did and is continuing to do. And Michael K. Williams absolutely smashed it. I mean, he is a fantastic actor, and to be honest with you, like, I know this is Ruby's episode, but I came away just thinking about that ballroom scene and thinking about Montrose, which is interesting, I guess. You guys took it differently. But I feel like this was one of the strongest episodes of the season. Like, the Ruby stuff I've been looking forward to since reading the book, I think it's a fascinating sort of short story, like most of these stories are. And I thought they did a pretty good job of it. I think the effects are absolutely out of this world good. Out of this world good. I I have never seen, because when you read this in the book, you're like completely like, this is disgusting. And I was kind of like, and I was like, the first time we saw it in the show today, I was like, there's not enough blood. I was like, first of all, I was like, when she woke up in the bed, I was like, there's not enough blood.
Yeah.
It's not as visceral as I wanted it to be. And then they completely proved me wrong because throughout the episode.
I was going to say, by the time we got to the end of it, that was the opposite.
Oh my word. It is so. Look. Obviously, the true nature of this show is horror in the, you know, the sense about race and the sense about the actual horror tropes, right? And we've discussed that. But I think the horror here on show of that metamorphosis is incredible. Like, I've never seen anything like it. Done as well as this. There's a couple of instances I'll talk about in Cthulhu Corner, but nothing as good as this.
So does that mean you're going to give it a 5 blue blend?
No, it's not 5. It's 4 blueberry. Sorry. It's a 4 blueberry because I still think it's one of the stronger episodes. Like, 4 is a very good score, obviously, but I think there's better in the season. Sundown being my favourite episode so far, I think, the premiere. Okay. But there's a lot to discuss with Ruby and what the storyline means in terms of, like, struggling to pretend to be something that society deems you to be, and then like shedding that persona. And there's also Montrose emerging from his sort of cocoon or chrysalis in this episode, which is, I think, very important to talk about, just the larger theme there, which I love. But 4 bloops for me, and I think it was a very good, very tight, very interesting episode.
Well, we can discuss and agree or disagree as we go through the plot. But
disagree
first,
mostly.
Last but not least, Lucy, what did you think of episode 5?
I'm going to echo kind of all of you, because I think you've all made good points. And I will say that watching this, especially Ruby's storyline, I think it was the best I have found the show. I thought it was such an interesting storyline. And the way it worked, it wasn't perfect. There were aspects of what happens that I found quite either fell flat or didn't work quite well. Like, and what you said about Montrose, Gaz, about it's hard to care about him after what he did to Yahima. Like, I completely agree with that. But I agree with you, Len, that the way that scene was shot was beautiful. And transformative again. But yeah, I think I actually really enjoyed watching this episode, probably more than any of the others, because it kind of stuck with Ruby and that story. And I think it kind of showed me that I'm really not interested in Tick. I really don't think I'm that interested in what he's doing with these pages. And it's just not that interesting to me. Whereas this was like quite a linear narrative of one thing that it focused on. And I thought, I felt really quite engaged with it. And it was absolutely disgusting and disturbing. I'm also going to give it 4 blueberries. I think it's probably the best, probably my favourite episode.
The two L's on the same wavelength.
Elves. Thank you very much, Lucy.
L power,
well,
yeah.
An interesting mix, actually, between us. So it'll be interesting to see what we think about individual parts of it as we talk through the plot. But before we do that, I'm just going to swing over to Len for a little advert break.
Hello, yes, advert time here at Lovecraft Country Critical. And this week, simple ask, all we need you to do is click the subscribe button. If you're enjoying listening to this, please do subscribe to the podcast. We appreciate all your support. But if you're bored of us talking about Lovecraft Country and say you want to listen to us talk about Marvel's Avengers or Stranger Things or Game of Thrones or The Walking Dead, or Westworld, or Watchmen, etc., etc. Yes, we've done a lot of podcasts. All you have to do is search Fan Critical on any podcast app, platform, Spotify. That's Fan Critical. And on there, we've got over 220 podcasts covering all of those things, where you have me, Lucy, Emma, John, and Gaz discussing absolute garbage at times as well, like the worst of Netflix. We've done a How the Fuck Have You Not Seen That series. That's brilliant. Check that out. That's a lockdown series. So if you're in lockdown and you need something to listen to, check that one out. Fan Critical. Also, you can sponsor us further at Patreon. You can go to www.patreon.com/fancritical. And on there, you can give us some precious dollary dues. That goes towards operating costs. It goes towards us creating more content for you guys.
And feeding John.
You do... and feeding John, who we've obviously had to sideline in this podcast. Thank God. But there's also a chance on there to commission a podcast. We've done several commission podcasts now. We've done like World War Z, Hereditary, Midsummer, No Country for Old Men. The list goes on. So go to patreon.com/fancritical. Any financial support that we get is so greatly appreciated and it means the world to us. So that's patreon.com/fancritical. And one last thing, please do leave us a review on iTunes. It has been a great show for us. We've getting a lot of positive feedback, occasionally this slight bit of negative feedback, but that's the nature of the beast. But we would just love your opinions on the show. Please do leave us a review. Go on iTunes and leave the podcast a lovely little review, and that would be greatly appreciated. 5 bloobs, please. Back to Emma.
Okay, so this episode opens up with a woman, a white woman, lying in bed, naked, and draped in satin sheets. Yes, she's looking familiar. She starts looking at her hands in confusion, and then she seems to be seriously panicking. So then she jumps up and she rushes to the mirror, and you can just hear her saying, wake up, Ruby, to her reflection before we hit the title scene, which is really interesting because obviously you've got Lovecraft Country. And then you've got Ruby's face, which is different, which is really interesting. So Ruby, in inverted commas, who we've probably all now assumed is this lady, heads out into the street looking absolutely fucking bonkers, right? Crazy, mad. So the police arrive. She automatically jumps back, put her hands up, and they start accusing a young black man next to her, basically, of molesting her because she's a white woman in a black neighbourhood, which is kind of very reminiscent of our conversation last week about Emmett Till. And I imagine many, many others untold are the same ilk. But regardless, she then takes a ride in the back of the car with the cops, and they're explaining that they're taking her back to her husband, who turns out to be William, waiting for her. And as he carries her back inside, we see her skin start to bulge, and she looks like she's having some kind of quite serious attack from her body inside out. Gaz, what did you think was happening here?
Is it boring if I say I thought she was turning back into Ruby? Because that is what I thought was happening.
Yeah, no, make something else up.
No, that's fine.
make something up.
I thought she was turning into a dragon.
Oh, what? Game of Thrones!
That would be cool. It was pretty horrific. Like, the cracking sound that accompanied this was putting me on edge, to be honest.
It made me feel like, what was the Stephen King adaptation where one of them talked about their sister dying from meningitis?
Oh, Pet Sematary. Pet Sematary.
Yeah. It reminded me of that when you saw her all like distended and horrible. And I mean, awful. And I'm very sorry for bringing up such a traumatic thing, but that was what immediately came into my head. And I was like, this is wrong. I don't like it.
Yeah.
I like it.
No, very unpleasant. And I mean, I'll be honest. I know you sort of after William brings her back in and has her on the floor on the plastic. And you know something is about to happen.
American Psycho.
Murderer. Very American Psycho.
It's murdering
proper.
And she's like, I don't want to die. William's response,
isn't the best.
It's not the most reassuring, is it?
He would say metamorphoses isn't death, and we're like, what?
Yeah.
I don't want that either, so
neither of those options is brilliant.
I choose neither.
Then just obviously it sort of fades. Not fades. It focus changes and it's blurred, but it's still horrific and you still hear it. And I was like, this is one hell of a start to this show.
Yeah,
I'm already. This is a lot.
This bit of the scene. So he's taken out a knife and we see him stabbing her in the chest. And then as it pans out, like you say, it unfocuses. It focuses in on the TV and you've got a guy on the telly talking about locusts shedding their skin while you can see him just slicing away at Ruby in the background. Fucking gross.
Carving her up.
Yeah. I mean, like, Len, this is slightly different to probably what we were expecting. How did that...
Yes, better. It's better. It's way better than the book. the book is obviously, it describes it as best it can. But this bit, I was like, Jesus, they're really going for a bit of the violence. I was like, why is he cutting her open? This is weird. But yeah, I loved it. I loved the American Psycho vibe. William, for me, is becoming, Wistino is becoming a... is becoming a better... Is becoming a better character for me as the show goes on. I actually really like William in this episode.
Let's just call him Wiener.
He's fulfilling the Caleb Braithwaite sort of role more and more as the show goes on. And I love this whole storyline with Ruby. I was excited, like, reading it in the book. I found it fascinating. Just in terms of, like... you talk about a social commentary in this show, and this short story is like a social experiment, yeah, really. Isn't it?
Len, I saw a comment online that I thought was quite interesting. That was like, what's happened here is that they've turned whiteness into a drug that Ruby's got addicted to, and right. It's almost like she has that first taste, sort of a horrific experience in a lot of ways, but then it's like, oh, I've got to give this another go.
We imbue her with power that she never had. And I said last week about, you know, white women being like, their privileges are second only to white men. And this episode proves it, because she goes and has a lovely day. Mm-hmm. She has free ice cream.
Free ice cream.
I saw a similar comment, Gaz, but it was saying that magic is whiteness. And so when they're talking about the magic and the protection, that's a kind of a stand-in for whiteness. So, similar.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think what's really interesting about it, you know, and we'll obviously talk about the rest of what actually happens, but is the way that so many things Ruby does and says as a white woman come across so differently than if she were to say them and do them as a black woman. And I think that's what when I said I felt uncomfortable, that's where I felt really uncomfortable in this episode. I mean, there are other particular examples, you know, towards the end, perhaps, where I felt distinctly uncomfortable. Ruby, thanks for that. But yeah, I think it's fascinating. I mean, this episode is split basically between Ruby's story and Montrose, really, apart from a couple of bits with Tick and Letty. So just after we see this happening, you know, and we leave Ruby being sliced up on the floor, we move to Montrose, who is just basically sitting in a chair looking pretty glum. And then Letty and Tick turn up looking for Yahima. When Tick works out that Yahima is no longer there, he goes bonkers, attacks Montrose. He's eventually pulled off. Don't be dirty, filthy little bugger. You've woken up, haven't you? he heads down to the basement, into the dark room. That.
Jesus.
Yeah, it really is. An English 15-year-old. He heads for the basement, he heads to the dark room, and he's lost it at this point. He's lost all control of himself. And he's asking Letty if she took pictures of the pages that they rescued. And as he's losing his temper and all of that control, he suddenly realizes that Letty is shaking and she's holding the baseball bat that she keeps for protection because she's scared of him. Yep. And I, like, you know, to an extent, Luce, I get what you mean about not really caring about Tick, because this part of the story, especially in this episode, just could have been left on the back burner a bit.
Yeah.
But I think the two of them together are quite powerful. I think they've got good chemistry, and I think this particular scene was really impactful for me. I mean, did it have any effect on you, or do you just not give a shit?
I think it was just because I found the Ruby story so interesting, cutting back to this and just, oh, we need to find bits of paper again. It's like, I don't really care. But I agree that their chemistry is really good. I think the quest for the paper. Letty is an amazing character, and I think she's like been the standout of the season. And I haven't really felt like that way about Tick from the start, but I think it's just this episode. I was like, I don't really care. But when he spoke about the impact his father's behaviour had on him growing up, and how he swore he never would be like that until he went to the war, and it was like he was given permission to act out all of his rage. And yeah, seeing how it affects Letty, and she doesn't know at that point. She quite naively thinks that Montrose is let Yahima go. Like, where would she have gone? She's not an animal that she's been let out the back door.
Wandering the streets.
Yeah, very naive there. But it kind of annoyed me a bit as well that it was like, no, he killed her. Anyway, back to these bits of paper. Like, why introduce this amazing character if you're just going to go bleep?
I think this relates to last week's title of the episode. I actually don't mind the Atticus stuff this week, but mainly because it involves Montrose. But like, because last week it was called A History of Violence, right? Yeah. The episode was called A History of Violence. And that is what we're seeing play out before our eyes. Like, Montrose,
yeah, that's a good point,
and we'll get onto more of him later on. But we know he had an abusive father. We know that he is not comfortable living in his own skin.
Yeah.
And we're sort of understanding why he's doing the things that he does to Tick. And we talked about it last week about how sometimes parents, especially in African-American households at the time, were being hard on their kids to prepare them for the world that they were going to go into. We talked about this last week. And that is what Montrose was doing to Tick. And what's happened is, throughout their relationship growing up, Tick has always had these scuffles with Montrose, whether it's about literature, whether it's about interviews that he was going to give about him being in the war, which we've heard about earlier in the season. Yep. It's all been brewing to a head. And this is the first time that we know of that Tick has absolutely destroyed lost control and destroyed his father. So it's been building up to that point. It's a history of violence in the family, a history of violence between these two characters. And the cycle is repeating itself, it seems, you know, and we don't want to see Tick go down this same path. And I don't think he will. I think obviously he's got a lot of scars from the war, and I'm sure we'll see more of that next week. But it's just interesting to me, this theme of a history of violence.
Any household of violence, there is a propensity to repeat that behaviour.
Yeah.
But does anyone
through
think...
Through no fault of one's own.
Does anyone think that... the pages themselves are kind of acting a bit like the One Ring in Lord of the Rings, in that Letty says these are the tool of the devil. So is this coming out of Tick because of his father, or are they all being corrupted by the power? Was Montrose corrupted by the power to kill Yahima? Is Tick corrupted by the power to beat the shit out of his dad? Like, it's a corrupting influence I think.
Tick's argument is that the war was the corrupting influence on him, wasn't it?
I think it's interesting if they did go down that route, if they did go down a route of this, the Book of Names being like the One Ring, Lucy. Unfortunately, I don't think they are going to do that.
Because you know, you're like, that's not happening. It's not the One Ring.
Look, the book, but they're not really following the book, like 100%.
I think it's like anything. It's forbidden knowledge makes man, as in the race of mankind, not just men, make decisions one way or the other. You know, whatever that knowledge or that kind of power that they're gathering can make you make good or bad decisions. And I think, you know, he says later on, it's how what you decide to do with it, you know, it's not inherently bad in itself, it's what we decide to do with it morally. While we're with Tick and Letty, actually, let's just skip on to their next scene, because I think there's a nice run after that with Ruby. So they're back together. He's licking his wounds. Not almost literally, actually. He's cleaning them. Letty says that she has taken pictures of the pages, and then we have that conversation about the violence he experienced as a child with Montrose, because she asks him, if I hadn't been there, would you have killed him? And he said he would have thought about it when he was younger. And we get this like this admission from Letty that side of him really scares her. And I wonder if she's ever experienced any fear of violence like that before, because it feels like she hasn't.
Yeah, in the book we know more about her father being a massive gambler who...
But a very good professional gambler.
Yeah, and taught her how to play poker and stuff like that, which makes her as a very cunning character in the book, and she is a very cunning character here, so we can only guess that wisdom was passed down onto her. But I don't know about any violence within her household. It's hard to say. Her mother was a very devout Christian and psychic, remember. So it's an interesting household that she grew up in, but we don't know much more about it than that.
No. What we do know, though, talking about households, is that we had another sex scene, and this time my parents didn't walk in while it was on.
Oh, nice.
Bonus.
So that was a relief.
So you can, we can dispel the theory that it was your parents walking in that caused sex scenes.
That's, we can, yes. Thankfully. Yes.
I thought this was a nice, tender moment for these two characters. You know, they're doubling down on their relationship in the show, and like me and Emma have said, you know, Atticus,
I think it works,
takes a bit more of a back seat during the book now, and it's all these other individual characters, and you stay with them, really. But to see this, and a lot of this stuff probably happens off screen, as it were, in the book. So it's great to actually have two characters who we care about, Letty being my favourite character in the show, and like just, you know, having a moment of happiness in amongst all the horror that's going on around them is quite nice.
Yeah, it is. But we don't get to escape from horror for long, because we're going to go back to Ruby and William now. So back in the bedroom, William is talking to us about butterflies how they live and die and then grow again into another caterpillar from the cocoon of the dead one, which is rank.
Does that happen? Is that
and he
real?
Talks about... I didn't look it up, Lucy, if I'm honest. It was a bit... wrote in my notes was, yay, science time.
Caterpillars don't die. They turn into a butterfly.
No, I know, but he said then butterflies die and then a caterpillar comes from that. That doesn't seem right. Okay, good.
If that is true, all of the books I read, like the children's books I read when I was younger, Hungry Caterpillar.
Yeah.
Hungry Caterpillar. Well, I need a sequel to that. I need a sequel to that.
The Rebirth. Yeah.
The Very Hungry Butterfly. but he starts talking about how he has all of these theories and they've only ever been theoretical until he met Hiram Epstein.
Mm-hmm.
Hiram? Mm. Hiram.
Yeah, you know it's Hiram.
Why are you bad at this?
So then he starts talking about magical doorways, which is exciting. But the interesting part of this, I think, is that when Ruby starts talking about, and you've mentioned this, Lucy, how she was treated differently. People were scared for her, not of her, in that situation.
Yeah.
Mm. And William stands there and he goes, well, look, here's the vial. If you want to do it again, here it is. And he plonks it down next to a huge wedge of cash, which felt a bit sort of, thanks for your services.
Yes.
And there is literally no time to wonder if she's going to take it or not, because the next scene is her going out as this white woman. This is where she gets a free ice cream. That doesn't happen to anyone.
Cardi B.
She's walking down the street and she keeps stopping because she feels like she's in the way, and she's not. And it's amazing to watch her do that. I mean, Gaz, what did you think about her choosing to do it again?
Well, like I said, the comment about it being a drug, it's kind of like that, and she's got William as the facilitator, the provider
pusher.
Of the drug, the pusher,
the dealer,
the dealer. Yep, all of the words and
all of the drug words.
And it's interesting that, you know, she's like, this isn't happening again. That was it. I'm done. But once it's there in front of her, she can't resist. And you know, it's funny how different a light is painted on this era, isn't it, of 50s Chicago.
Completely.
And you know, this version, obviously, from her perspective, from our perspective watching, this version of Chicago in the 50s is so idyllic and wonderful, and it just paints over everything that we know is below the surface.
All the other bad stuff that we've been seeing is just, you know, forgotten in this
just removed
1 minute montage of her wandering around the streets.
And it's
an incredible contrast.
It's a dreamlike scene as well.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what it feels like. It doesn't. A lot of her scenes sort of play out like a dream. They're a bit surreal, and
they've almost got that kind of rose tinted tinge to them, haven't they?
Yeah.
Where it doesn't quite, until later on, where it doesn't quite feel real. But I think that's because it's hard to see that being reality when we've been so immersed in what it's like for the other side, so to speak. But after her first day properly out as who she's now chose to be, Hilary Davenport, we find out later, she's taking a bath back at William's place. And he comes in to wash her back. That's lovely, isn't it? And she basically says, like, why have you chosen me? I'm not special.
And he says he saw magic in her, but she will owe a friend of his a favour at some point in the future. Until then, she can do as she pleases in whichever skin she likes. And then Ruby brings up something, you know, and we've talked about, you know, whiteness as a drug and, you know, that kind of thing. But she mentions whiteness as a currency, which I thought was quite an interesting concept. And then she says, you know, I don't know which is harder, being a woman or being black. You know, normally I'm happy with both. And I think she'll probably change her mind about that shortly. What do you think about what William said to her about kind of seeing magic in her and their relationship together, Lucy?
Do we trust him? I don't know. I mean, we obviously know what he really is. But, I mean, at this point, he's saying, I saw magic
in you.
Not
now, we don't know.
I think, obviously, she's got the link to the Winthrop house, and I think that's what he's interested in. And yeah, this is a way of kind of, like Gail said with the drug thing, you get her addicted to doing this and then she'll probably do whatever you want, do whatever bidding you want. It's quite an interesting relationship, although it annoyed me when he like went in and then immediately got the towel. It's like, I'm not done with the bath yet. Why are you getting the towel immediately? Like, you haven't consulted me to see if I want to get out of the bath.
For hours.
These things just annoy me. No, it's an interesting dynamic between them. And when he, I know it's skipping ahead, but when he sort of picks her up as Hillary outside the store, you can see she is quite like happy enamored about it. Like happy that the stupid Burks that she works with see it. But also it's just, like cool guy.
Burks.
Cool guy. Burks.
Are we going like 1990s insults today?
Yeah.
You fucking so Burke.
Burke.
I'm trying to not swear as much. But yeah, it's an interesting dynamic between them for sure.
I was surprised that they went down the route that I think Ruby's very... I think in the book she's a bit more, let's say, standoffish with Caleb, it is in the book, but with William, let's just say William. Like she doesn't like him. She knows something nefarious is going on. She doesn't kiss him on the lips and all that sort of stuff. Like she's very much swooned by him in the show, and that caught me a bit off guard because I was a bit like, I think Ruby's a bit. I think she's a smart character. I think she's obviously, like you said, Gareth, they've gone down this more of a sort of it's a drug route, and she's sort of just riding the wave at the moment, which I thought was interesting. But you know, we see some of the nefariousness later on in this episode, so you know. She's on it.
Well, look, Ruby decides to use her new skin to go to the department store she's always wanted to work in for an interview. So here turns up Hillary Davenport. She tells this really crafted story of her background that, you know, she's come from a tiny little town in Maine and this, that and the other. She gets a challenge from Mr. Hughes, the manager, about, you know, how do you feel about working with coloureds, is what he says, and then gets the role of assistant manager. And then right at the end of this scene, she's shooting out, and before she can actually get any further, she starts convulsing again and then like bleeding from her skin. Gaz, how did this work for you? Because it worked really well for me.
Yeah, I mean, it was, it reminded me, or it made me think of like when you're in an interview and you really, really badly need the toilet.
Yeah.
You're like, oh my god, this is
I've got to go.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Did you have any final points to make in support of your application? No, I've got to go. Bye. And yeah, I mean, again, the cracking and the. I mean, Mr. Hughes doesn't realise anything's going on, but obviously she runs off. She leaves her. Her potion behind, which it interested me in so much as it seemed to not have an impact.
I thought
this is going to be bad. She's going to end up sort of stalking the streets in sort of a viscera coated, naked, bloody, But instead, it was just like scene over. So, okay, well, why did it matter that she left her potion behind? It wasn't...
Well, I mean, there wasn't really a resolution to that.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. What's the... Like, that would have been incredible. What's the sort of... The stage that
would he become a white woman or a black man?
Black man, I think, maybe. judging by what he wants to do later
on. No, Black Woman.
Well, I think you guys have a bit more to learn about this potion, but I won't spoil it.
Does it turn him into an eagle?
I won't spoil what the potion, where it comes from.
2-foot goblin.
Ooh. Butterflies, we already know.
Well, look, after this, we then get to kind of start Montrose's storyline in this episode. And it's a really short scene where he goes to visit Sammy from the bar. So we met him earlier on in the season. He's got a really badly swollen eye. There is basically no dialogue in this at all. Nope. But this is where we get the confirmation about their relationship, that there is something physical between them. I think romantic between them. They have sex, and it's clearly a very specific release that Montrose needs. He needs to be with Sammy because things have gone so, so wrong. I mean, Len, you talked about really liking Montrose's storyline. This first bit I felt was a bit not quite enough. But, you know, how did you feel about it?
I think this dovetailed with the scene in the ballroom and the scene where they're getting ready to go to this party. I think all of it marries together very nicely as a little narrative story about Montrose. I mean, this is interesting. We talked about this last week. It's interesting to me because Montrose is a far less he's complicated in the book, but they've really doubled down. I think they've looked at it and gone, we've got Michael K. Williams here. Let's give this character more range. Mm. Let's give him, you know, torment. Let's give him conflicting issues that he has to deal with. Because like we said, his whole life growing up, he had an abusive father. And that's obviously because of, because he's gay, because he's a homosexual man. And that to me, that makes his character much more interesting. It makes his decisions far more understandable in a way, but also, as I said, not forgivable for killing Yhema. Don't take that as me forgiving him, because I do not forgive him for that.
It but gives it him so much more depth, doesn't it? And it gives his character depth. More explainable.
Yes. I think it grounds his anger. That's the thing. Yeah, grounds his anger.
Yeah,
because he can't be who he wants to be. And that goes back to this theme in this episode of metamorphosis, change, acceptance.
That's all fine. None of it justifies something. None of it justifies what he did last week. Are you supposed to be like, oh yeah, okay, fair enough, kill Yhema because you've got some repressed sort of sexuality and you don't feel comfortable in this society, so that explains it? I don't think so. Maybe it explains being a bit of a shit dad, but
yeah,
it doesn't.
I think what this show is doing quite well, and look, we love grey characters. Game of Thrones being a perfect example of a series where there are characters who do unspeakable things. I'm going to say Jaime Lannister for one, but then you love the character. Montrose did an unspeakable thing, but he's a grey character, and I think the show is doing a very good job of that. Yeah, of course it doesn't excuse what he did to Yhema last week. Yes, it makes it slightly more understandable. I think the reason he killed Yhema is more because of this history of violence sort of narrative and that we discussed earlier. But he's a grey character. I love grey characters. I love the way that they make me love them, then hate them, then question what I would have done in that situation and so forth. So I think they're doing a pretty good job with Montrose, you know, not just giving us a, hey, he's a good guy, hey, he's a bad guy. You know, interpreting his characters is fun. It's interesting.
I don't quite agree. Like, the difference with Jaime Lannister is that at the time you go, like, I can see why he's done this thing. It's a terrible thing to have done, and it makes him a terrible person. But considering that he's a terrible person, I get why he's done it. With Yhema, I'm just left going, I don't understand. That's really frustrating. Like, I don't get this. Mm. And
we don't have an explanation for it, I think, is the thing, isn't it?
And there's no like, right now they're trying to redeem him without explaining why it happened.
Yeah, I think the problem, because that the ballroom scene is beautiful, but to frame it as some kind of cathartic release for Montrose and to ask us to care about that when he's murdered Yhema and we've not really had much sort of development on that is the difference. But if in Game of Thrones, you know, Jamie Lannister push Bran out of a window, and then the next minute you're seeing him and they're trying to make him like into a good guy, or like, oh, but look at him, he's having a happy time. Yeah.
How jarring would that
look
be?
At him picking flowers.
It wouldn't work. It's completely different.
Should we talk about the ballroom scene now, Em?
Yeah, I was going to say, let's just finish Montrose's story, because I think that actually we've got into a good conversation about it. So the other two scenes that we have is when all the guys are getting dressed up in their beautiful drag. And then we head to the club where Sammy is performing, looking stunning. Montrose, very kind of forlorn. And then the whole thing changes, and it is a really beautiful scene. Mm. I mean,
it's so exciting that there's all the drag race women, well, men, Shangela and Monet Exchange. Yeah. I was watching it, I was like, Shangela!
Oh, I knew I recognised some faces.
And Shangela is in A Star is Born as well. So I was extremely excited. Yeah. So that was very fun.
Yeah, that's true.
I think it was just that moment where they dance together and then they kiss.
Yeah.
And. Mm. Montrose has gone from seeming so lost and broken, and I think like unengaged really, to all of a sudden kind of letting go, and I think being a part of something when he feels so apart from everything. I mean, Gaz, you and I both gave the episode a 3. Like, Len, I know, really loved this scene. What did you think about it?
Well, I really liked this scene as well, but I liked this scene just as a standalone bit of TV. It reminded me of the sort of thing that like a channel would include in an advert about their channel. Do you know what I mean? Like the dramas, like wonderful dramas. And like there's that scene of him sort of standing with his arms out and the camera sort of panning up from him.
The Shawshank shot.
But it was beautifully shot. The music was beautiful. But I would have loved watching it if I had just been dumped into that scene without having seen anything that happened before. I don't think I liked it because I was like, oh, redemption for Montrose, or yes, an explanation of who Montrose is. I loved it for the visuals and the music and the acting, and that's the thing. Like, there's no audible dialogue, but just his face is enough. And you don't need to. I think I loved it, despite the narrative meaning not very much to me.
Lonely World, I'll put it in here, by Moses Sumney, is an absolutely beautiful song.
You're such a soundtrack nerd.
I think this show, and we've had a bit of conversation about this, we all have different opinions, and online there are so many different opinions about how this show is using modern day music juxtaposed with the imagery, and sometimes it doesn't work. And I think there's a couple of times this episode where it doesn't work. However, this is the perfect way to use music to tie sort of a retro scenario and a situation with modern day music. It was beautiful and empowering, and I know this sounds mad, something about this scene just hits me. Like, I know we talked about you can't care about Montrose, but I was so against what he did last week. If you listen to last week's podcast, I was clearly like angry, wasn't I?
You supported his right to do it, you said.
It's the right option.
Oh my God, imagine if I did that. Imagine how many Montrose Five Blues, what you said last week. The feedback we would have got if I said that. This literally got me right in the feels. It's the most beautiful scene in the show so far, in my opinion. I loved everything about it. I just absolutely adored it.
It is so beautifully shot and acted, and it just, his face, like you say, it's almost like you can see the weight lifting when he finally gets to smile and they kiss. Yeah, it's gorgeous. And it doesn't what happened before doesn't detract from the scene, but I do think framing it as like a redemptive thing for Montrose or cathartic for me doesn't work, because he hasn't said a fucking word about Yhemah, and I don't think we'll probably ever hear about her again, and that's quite annoying.
No.
I was going to say, it's going to be interesting to see what happens after this. Is he just going to go back into his shell? That'll be interesting to see, because
I think
this feels like a moment, and I hope they follow that on.
Well, look, I mean, we'll wait and see what happens next episode, but there could certainly be some good ways that they could continue this. Even on the redemption arc.
More drag queens, I say.
Yeah, I say more drag queens.
Defo.
And more Cardi B.
Well, let's let's talk about Ruby's time at the department store. So I apologise to everyone listening that we're not necessarily going chronologically with the episode, but I think it makes sense to stay on a stream. So Ruby's first day at work. Mr. Hughes is very, very nice to her. And
Mr. Hughes. Is that his name?
He's such a fucking creep, man. So there are a few things that happen in these first scenes. So firstly, she is talking to Tamra, who is the black woman who has got the job on one of the counters. And she's talking to her about her qualifications and how she really needs to be, you know, not just average, but fantastic. Then it's contrasted with a scene of her in the break room with the rest of the ladies, which turns pretty awkward. And then it kind of closes off with William turning up outside and all the girls being like, oh, who's that?
They prefer to be called Berks, I think, Emma.
Yeah, all those fucking Berks.
The correct term.
So, Gaz, this sort of trio of scenes, how did they land for you? Because you, like me, really enjoyed Ruby's story, didn't you?
Yeah. I think I like these sort of elements of the show more than anything, is the sort of little self-contained stories. I mean, it's not quite self-contained, mm-hmm. but you know what I mean. Like, it works as its own mm-hmm. little mini story.
Little vignettes.
Yeah.
Twilight Zone.
Yeah, it's a bit like that. And it's interesting to have... I think it's really hard for an actor to play like a character that is pretending to be somebody that they're not, if you know what I mean. It's like the double character thing. And there were times where I don't know, I found the acting a little jarring throughout this. But then I was thinking to myself, maybe it's supposed to be like this. And I'm sure it is. So, for example, the way that she's talking to Tamra, I was getting really kind of mixed messages, and it was such an uncomfortable conversation.
Mm.
I think that was intentional.
I think so.
Like initially I was like, oh, I don't get it. Isn't she trying to be pleasant? Like, why has everything got such an edge to it? But I think that is the entire point, is that...
Well, this is what I said at the beginning about, like, some things may come out of a person's mouth that sound perfectly normal. So if Ruby had said that as Ruby, it would have been really supportive and positive. But because she says it as Hillary, she sounds like an absolute twat.
A Burke. Mm. Total Burke.
A Burke. Total Burke. Sorry, Gaz, carry on.
Yeah, and I guess it's fascinating how she has that approach with Tamra, where I think she's almost like the conversation she has about the fact that she has to be better than everybody else is fascinating. And like we're saying, if that had come from Ruby, that would have been a motivational speech. Coming from Hillary, it's extremely condescending.
Yeah.
That's a fascinating dynamic to see at play.
Mm.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, Lucy, what about the dynamic in the break room with all of the other department store girls, you know, trying on clothes and having Berks. This conversation about going to the other side of the city, the south side, and, you know, that.
Berks, yeah. That what I found quite interesting about this, and it was a bit unexpected, was that when they're, you know, saying their things, Ruby doesn't get defensive straight away. She's not like in there defending black people. She kind of tries to still ingratiate herself a little bit, and like, well, as long as they're qualified, and she doesn't actually say anything outright that would, you know, blow her cover, because then no one's going to guess what's actually happened, but even just to blow her cover that, that she's not like a horrible racist like they are. And it was interesting as well, yeah, when she started dancing, and I think it ties in later that when Ruby's speaking to Christina and she's saying like, white women want to be us, we want to be them. And it's, you know, they all like, oh, they'll take us to the south side because it's fun, because it's cool. They want to like fit in with that, and kind of they would probably love to take a trip to that side of life like Ruby's doing, but Ruby's going the opposite way. So yeah, I found it really interesting, and just, you know, the way her like body would tense up at certain things. And yeah, I thought it didn't go the way I thought it was going to, but that made it better for me.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, isn't it? And I actually, everything that happens has a point in this episode. It has a something behind it, and some of it is just here feel awkward because actually, you know, this is a really uncomfortable thing to hear come out of that person's mouth, or, you know, whether it's just making you think a bit more about what it is that, you know, people want what they don't have, so to speak. I mean, look, so William turns up, and he has turned up to call in his favour, which is for Ruby to attend a party at which she'll meet Christina to give her instructions. Then he gifts her a box that you assume is going to be a ball gown, and it's a maid's uniform. I don't know why I said it like that.
Yeah, it's just good. It's
a maid's uniform. This meeting, this event, she turns out to be a meeting of the lodge. So we've got the police captain, Lancaster, and a bunch more Sons of Adam. And Christina basically asks her to hide something in the captain's office, which Ruby is against until she hears the story that William is allegedly the rightful heir to this lodge. Lancaster killed him and dumped him in the river, and still thinks he's dead. Len, this was a surprise to me, as I'm sure it was to you too.
Yeah, so the interesting, I'll talk about book differences a little bit now and stuff like that, because in the book, she goes to the party as Hillary, and she pretends to be a member of a lodge, or like a leading member of a lodge from like Nantucket, I think it is, or something.
I'm pretty sure it's Nantucket, yeah.
Yeah, it's really weird. And then she talks to loads of the different lodge members, and you sort of, what it does is it gives you more of an impression of the sort of politics that goes on within the Order of the Ancient Dawn, which I think we need to get a bit more of, because at the moment it just seems a bit like they're sort of not really focusing on that, which is quite an interesting part of the book. Yeah, but the sort of situation's the same. Yes, Captain Lancaster, he is a dick in the book, he's a dick in the show. They're doing some really weird thing with his character in the show. I'm not really sure. Did you guys pick up on when he took his top off?
What
was going on there?
So not only in that scene have we got some guy in the closet bleeding and all cut up and like strung up to the ceiling. Also, Captain Lancaster has some kind of weird skin graft all over his torso. Like, what the fuck is happening here? Anyone?
Well, this might explain the experimentation on, we talked about in episode 3, the experimentation on African Americans, and how he was partnered with Hiram Epstein, the crazy, horrible scientist who was doing those awful experiments. And it seems that he's continuing his work, or the work was for him because maybe he had some sort of injury. And I don't know. I'm interested to see where that storyline goes, because it's something that I've not read. It's not in the book. So I'm really interested to see how that evolves. But yeah, this stuff's good. I do like the way that it feels weird to me. They've given Ruby the power to be this Hillary character, but they actually need her for who she actually is. And that's an interesting...
Which is quite powerful, isn't it?
It's quite powerful. It's quite powerful. It says, look, we actually need you. We don't need Hillary. So I'm sure that will evolve as well as the sort of weeks go on.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Lucy, what did you think about the whole, they think William's dead, William's not dead? Obviously, this is pre-reveal at the end of the episode.
Yeah, what I thought was, oh, he's the heir to the lodge. Like, how can he be the heir to the lodge? Because I thought he was just like a manservant to the Braithwaites.
Yeah.
Confusing, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was my first inkling that, like, what? And yeah, you never see them together, and they look pretty similar as people. But what I wonder, knowing what I know now, did William ever exist? Or is he really dead? Or has she just inhabited his body?
Well, this is it, Lucy.
All good questions, Lucy.
All good questions that will be revealed. I'm sure.
I don't really want an answer. I'm just positing them for the audience.
There are questions. Yeah. Questions that will be answered, but not in this episode, I think, is the answer to that.
I was going to say about the Christina and William thing, like last week, I was so close to say, because it's not book canon necessarily, but I was so close to saying, I think they're the same person.
Well, convenient that you didn't actually say it.
And then I didn't
it.
Say it. Mm. I promise you, yeah. I promise you, I didn't say it.
I thought that after episode one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They weren't in it, but I thought it.
Yeah.
Well,
look, let's go downtown for some drinking, shall we? So the department store Burke's have asked to be taken to the south side. So they head to the bar, the only bar that we ever seem to go to. It's busy, it's lively, there's dancing and drinking, and the Burke's from the department store. I found this whole thing really uncomfortable and tense to experience, which I think was the point. And I think it was really interesting. So Ruby/Hillary seems to be struggling with this, and she heads outside with the serum and then actually decides to let herself change to the point where she is pulling at her own skin, shedding it like a weird old snake.
What happens to the skin? Does it just stay there and people bump into the skin?
She just left a pile of bits of flesh. Horrible. Yeah. But I think that was fantastic. There's another part of this scene that's important to note as well, which is that when she's transformed back into Ruby, you know, she's covered in blood and guts and gore, and through the panel she sees Mr. Hughes trying to assault Tamra, which is just fucking shit.
Yeah,
I mean, Gaz, you've got two things here. You've got shedding like a snake and attempted sexual assault. Take your pick.
Neither seems or like both, a brilliant option. The sort of shots of Ruby's face as she's watching it, like just sort of dimly lit and through a hole in the wall or whatever, that is proper like 80s body shock horror, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like horrendous. I don't know, like I think I'm not sure what my thoughts are on the purpose of Mr. Hughes, really. Like, did we need this from him? I think it's only really to justify what happens at the very end.
Well, I think it kind of shows that. Sorry, just to cut in there, Gaz, but she was hired. Tamra was hired without any qualifications, and it just shows that she was probably hired because of how she looks, because Mr. Hughes is interested in black women. So that's maybe some kind of vindication for Ruby that, you know, it's that.
Yeah, okay. That expands that a little.
Maybe, but I understand what you mean. She is not that necessary. But, when she's like, oh, yeah, you know, I never even graduated high school, and she's quite, like, perturbed by that, and I think maybe this just shows that he is not really pioneering if you're just being chosen because they want to sexually assault you, unfortunately.
I think this whole stuff in the alleyway is like really good. Like Gaz mentioned, the 80s sort of like peeping through the whole, you know, horror thing there. I think that's bang on. I think the transformation scene in this alleyway, because we get like more glimpses of it as it goes through the episode. And I know we have talked about the gore, but I just want to talk about it some more because I want to talk about the effects and how great they are. The bits where she's like pulling off her face here, it's just
amazing. It's so good.
As it hits the floor.
Honestly,
there's a bit where like a bit of face,
flaps
like,
off
a bit of
open.
Eye is sliding down her back.
Oh my god,
it's really grim, isn't it? It's brilliant.
Do you know what I thought? Can I just for a second? I thought at this point, I was like, is she going to just put that dress back on and go back out there?
I thought that.
This isn't going to work.
But it's amazing practical effects. It's incredible. Just sort of like, as a storytelling device, I think it's so good. Like, we talked about it earlier, about this chrysalis sort of thing. And I read somewhere about how this is sort of an example of how people of color and people who don't conform to a certain gender and all of that sort of stuff always try and like constrain themselves, keep themselves within somebody, like, because they can't ever sort of let themselves out, right? And then this is like literally physically tearing themselves apart, you know, in the process of doing that. And I thought that was, I read that somewhere. I was like, oh my God, that's so spot on about what this is trying to do. And I think it does a fantastic job of it in this episode. I mean, the stuff with Ruby and this transformation is horrific in so many ways, not just physically, but also just what she's going through every time she does it. So I loved it. And Mr. Hughes is a dick. I don't know if he deserves a stiletto up the ass, but...
Well, spoiler warning. I was going to say, you know. Let's get to that. So, like, after this, Ruby is sitting in the living room. Christina comes out of the basement, like, the only locked door in the house. And Christina tries the same conversation with Ruby that she tried with Letty, but Ruby isn't really having any of it. And then we flip to this next scene, which is the Mr. Hughes scene. So she goes as Hillary to quit her job, ostensibly. But actually what she does is she half seduces Mr. Hughes and then sodomizes him with a stiletto. Turns him over, basically says, I wanted you to see it was me, a black woman, that did this to you. You fuck. That was just... 50% of me was cheering Ruby on and the other 50% was trying not to vomit.
I don't know if this is a good step for Ruby's character.
No, I don't think so.
I thought it was a bit out of character. It then got me thinking maybe this is all about that corrupting influence again that Letty was talking about earlier. Yeah.
The one ring.
And that Lucy was talking about earlier.
The one page.
The one page.
The missing page.
How shit is that? Like, everyone fighting over one page.
I think the show's done it again where they've sort of like had a very good episode like in their grasp and then they do something at the end of the episode where I'm like, why have you done that? Like the Yhema thing last week, I obviously am a bit more like in outrage about that because I think for a show that's trying to give such a good social commentary message to then do what they did last week, I think was like, what the fuck are you doing? Like that just goes against everything you're trying to do with the show. And then this week, I feel like it's just silly and too much. Like Emma said, it's very graphic. And like, I get it, Mr. Hughes is a wanker, but there's bigger wankers in this show who deserve worse.
I think anyone ever deserves sexual assault to that extent. And I don't want to watch something and be like, whoop, whoop, because it was really graphic and awful. And I was ready for like a humiliation scene I was ready to cheer. And, you know, you've got a bit of Cardi B again. But, it left a bad taste in my mouth. But then I guess it's that Ruby uninterrupted. And maybe, like Gaz said, like maybe this is meant to be the way she goes, that she's actually got quite a lot of hatred and violence in her heart. And this is the result.
Yeah.
Or it could be the corruption of the One Ring.
Can I just clarify that when I said I was cheering her on, it was before the stiletto.
Well, you're going to have to do a lot of clarifying.
So when the stiletto happened, you were like, oh, I'm not sure about that.
Then I was getting really uncomfortable. Well, look, there's two more things that happen in this episode. One is the William, like Christina crawling out of William, which just so
good
blew me away because I was not expecting it. And yet I looked at it and thought I should have done. I mean, like, Gaz, you're making a frown face. Tell me.
No. I liked it. I think I was frowning because you didn't use the Wilfstina.
As agreed. Pseudonym.
Yeah.
Wiener.
Chrissium. No, I prefer Chrissium. Chrissium's better.
Chrissium. I don't like any of them.
Wilfstina's also quite good.
Yeah, Wilfstina.
Wilfstina.
It's
good, isn't it?
I think there had been a lot of chat online about whether they're the same person.
Yeah, probably me. Probably me spreading those rumours. Yeah.
Just Len everywhere.
Leonardo 7. I think that Will Steiner's the same person. Can you stop posting that everywhere, please, mate? Leonardo 6.
Will Steiner.
No, if it's me, it'll be Chrissium. You know that. So
I think earlier in this episode, I started thinking that. It wasn't like a long running thing where I was like, oh, I can't wait for that to be revealed. But yeah, kind of cool. And like Lucy said, there are a few mysteries still, a few questions that arise because of it. Like, is Will actually a person? Is he alive? Is he... what's going on?
It's interesting. Yeah. I think it gives the character of Christine, because I hate the character of Christina, really. I've said that several times. I don't know why they've made the change. I obviously know why they sort of made the change, to sort of say that, like, women in this world are also, you know, they don't have the same rights, because she should be the heir to the Braithwaite estate and all this sort of stuff. But it's interesting to me that she's having to use the potion to transform into William to get ahead in the world of Adam. And I think that's interesting to me. So it gives her character a bit more context. And I think it's a good step for her character, and it made her character far more interesting for me anyway.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens as we move on through the last sort of five episodes of the season. I mean, the last thing we see, and I've skipped over this a little bit, so Tick's doing a lot of deciphering of the language of Adam.
Decoding, yeah.
Yeah,
Enigma
blah, blah,
code.
Blah. And he seems to have made a breakthrough at the end, and he rushes to the telephone and makes a call to a woman, who I believe is Christina, correct me if I'm wrong, and basically says,
I think you're wrong.
It's the Korean girl now.
It's the Korean girl.
It's the Korean girl.
Gia.
Yeah. Gia.
How on earth did that happen? Okay, right. Can someone explain this to me then? Because I did not get this ending. So he makes the phone call, and then you see the word die on paper.
Yeah. So we don't know yet. And a little spoiler warning, next week we're going to the Korean War.
Cool.
So a whole episode at the Korean War, basically. So get ready for that. And we're going to find out more about this character next week. Because we don't know now. Like,
initially, I'll stop asking questions about it then.
Yeah, but yes, it relates to the phone call that he gave in episode one in Sundown, where he called this mysterious number, and they chatted for a brief second. I can't remember what was said, and then he's done the same call here, and we obviously had that scene in the sort of imagination, violent fight scene in the Braithwaite estate. In Arden. So there's pieces to put together of the puzzle here, and next week it looks like the puzzle will be coming together and we'll understand a bit more.
Well, look, talking about puzzles, I reckon it's time for Cthulhu Corner, Len, if you'd like to take
and
us through.
And lots of feedback.
Our listener feedback, etc.
Hello and welcome to Cthulhu Corner. All hail Cthulhu. Now, this week we've got a slightly shorter corner because we have a ton of feedback, but I thought it'd be cool just to talk about a few things. So the title, and Gareth has mentioned this, we've all mentioned it, Strange Case, is obviously in relation to a strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. There are many characters in this episode who we see different sides of. Ruby and William most obviously, but Montrose as well, as we've talked about, and even Atticus when he goes to his violent side, he almost kills Montrose.
I can't stop thinking about Dr. Gecko now from earlier.
Same.
Yeah. And Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is heavily referenced in the book. They literally read excerpts from the book whilst this whole Ruby storyline is going on, so they've literally just lifted that straight from the novel, which is great. I was going to talk to you, Gareth, about a lot of Lovecraftian horror and about how that actually focuses on transformation and mutation, but mainly they call it transformation in a very cosmic and unquantifiable ways, like stuff with the Cthulhu mythos. And Gaz, me and you watched Colour Out of Space recently.
We did.
And that how that involves a lot of transformation. It is actually very good. Yeah, watch it. If you want a really fucked up film, and Nicolas Cage is sort of Nicolas Cage best, which is kind of crazy Cage.
I
would suggest going to watch Colour Out of Space.
Yeah.
I love crazy Cage.
Honestly, it is properly crazy Cage.
Weird.
Properly crazy Cage.
Yeah. What was it called again?
Colour Out of Space.
Okay, let me write that down. Carry on, please.
But it's a lot of, like, Lovecraftian horror is about transformation, so I thought that was very interesting. Obviously, this is a lot more human. A lot more of a sort of human transformation. And then in terms of horror films that I sort of thought about when I was watching this, the most obvious one to me is David Cronenberg's The Fly. Something about the transformations in this episode felt very reminiscent of that to me. And that is also one of my favourite films ever. It is horrific. And I felt the practical effects were excellent in that, even like that 1970s film. And I think this film also does a fantastic job of showing the visceral nature of that transformation. And we talked about how, the sort of meaning behind that transformation as well. So very good stuff. Book differences. You know, Caleb or Christina, whatever, doesn't transform into William. That's his own character. All right. So it's a new thing. Ruby, as I said, is a lot more sceptical of Christina / William. And here she sort of seems to have a lot of affection for him, which I found quite interesting. And then Montrose, as I said, there's no inclination that he's gay in the books. Just he's a father who was abused whilst he was a kid and then mimics that abuse on his son Atticus. And it's this history of violence, which we discussed. And as I said, they're making Montrose a much more interesting layered character in the show, which, you know, is great when you've got Michael K. Williams, you know, give him the range to work with. Okay, that was a short Cthulhu corner, and now we move on to feedback, because boy howdy, we got a lot of feedback this week, guys. Boy howdy, have we got a lot of feedback. Mainly, you know, we put out this thing last week where we talked about how the show is extremely divisive, and how, you know, we wanted to start a dialogue with listeners and see how we could, you know, improve on certain things, or if we're doing an okay job with certain things, and also just discuss the sort of nature of the show, because, you know, we love listener feedback and we love discussing the show with you guys, most importantly. So we've got a very varied amount of feedback here. So let's crack on. First email is from Gail Krieger. Hello, Gail. She says, great podcast. It is enormously adding to my enjoyment of the show. So that's good. Good start. thanks, Gail.
We should probably end it there, not history, to be honest.
Goodbye. End it there. I know this is not a history podcast, but Tulsa is properly referred to as the Tulsa Race Massacre, not a race riot. I think that's my bad. I think I did that last week.
No, I think it was me, actually. And I clocked myself on it afterwards. So, sorry, Gail.
Sometimes
thank
when
you.
We just speak, we speak really quickly. We just, you know, because we're trying to get loads of information in. The word riot is often used to intentionally mislabel an event, which is, you know, a protest or an uprising. Riot implies wrongdoing.
That's a good point, that.
Is used to minimise and obscure the underlying history and triggering events. So obviously this was a massacre.
The different lexus has so much power.
It's a massacre. And, you know, we've discussed the Tulsa race massacre a lot in the Watchmen podcast, because as we said, that was heavily featured in that show. She also says, keep up the great work and thank you for your willingness to engage in a conversation around the issue of racism and Cthulhu.
Thanks Gail.
Next up, we've got an email from Liz. Hey guys, it's been a while, but I just watched all four episodes of Lovecraft and of course had to write in after listening to the coverage. The show is awesome. I've not read the books, so I love to hear you guys talk about some of the differences. Journey Smollett is absolutely killing it. I love that they mentioned Tulsa. I hope we get some time with them exploring that theme. HBO did it so well with Watchmen. I also learned about Sundown Towns, which I went immediately to Google to research after hearing it on the show. Anyway, I'm loving the show and can't wait to see what happens in the story. I need to know what they're going to do to Ruby. I'm worried about her. Giving the show and fan critical coverage 5 bloobs. Cheers, RIP George. Yes, RIP George. We miss you. God, I wish George was still in the show. I wish he was still in the show. He's still in the book. So if you miss George, go pick up the book, okay, and read it. In fact, I ask everyone to read the book, because I think the book also does a fantastic job. Doesn't it, Em? Does a great job.
It does. Excellent. And it's a short read, but yeah.
Next up, we have Lani. Good morning, all. Just want to say that of all of the podcasts I listen to, and there's quite a few, you guys are by far my favourite. I enjoy the shows and movies you cover, as well as the camaraderie you all have. Also, sorry for the long email, but here we go. Currently listening to your most recent podcast on Lovecraft Country, and I'm astounded to hear that you guys received criticism about the way you discuss racism. I guess I'm curious as to whether people were angry you were bringing it up, or were upset because they thought you were glossing over it. As a black American, I applaud the fact that you are tackling shows like Watchmen and Lovecraft Country that are so heavily steeped in racism. Furthermore, Not once have I felt that you've skated over the issue of race or anyway tried to downplay it. I'll stop it there. I think it's difficult, isn't it? Because we talked about this last week. Everyone interprets everything differently. And if we have skated over anything, we apologize. Some stuff does get cut from the podcast because basically we record for a very long time and then I have to edit this down to a digestible size for everybody. Otherwise we'd be here for like 4 hours discussing everything. So yes, if we have ever skated over anything, we do apologize. But as I said, there's a lot to sort of unpack with this show, if you get what I mean. I'll crack on. Lani goes on to say, the fact that you really readily admit to not knowing some of the nuances of American history, specifically when it comes to race relations, but then going so far as researching, gets you a round of applause from me. Race has always been and will continue to be a sensitive topic for a myriad of reasons. Some think it's taboo to discuss at all, and others get argumentative when you try to bring it up. I say the only way to eradicate racism is through classroom education, such as the 1619 Project. But if shows like Watchmen and Lovecraft Country can educate an entire group of viewers, then great. Continue to do what you do, guys. You do it well.
Thanks, so, Lani. That's a really
I think that is also true. Email. We mentioned, yeah, thank you, Lani. We do appreciate that. I think it's also fair to say, right, guys, that it, like we said last week, it's a divisive show. It's a divisive subject matter. Like, just because, you know, we don't think it's divisive, you know, we just want to discuss it. But some people have very strong opinions on this subject matter. And I think that comes through in the subreddit. I think it comes through in the Facebook fan groups. I think it comes through in podcasts about the show. I think it's just one of those shows which causes a good, healthy conversation. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. Next one from FM, who had some opinions on last week's episode and some questions. Maybe I nodded off, but I completely did not understand how they ended up back at Letty's house after their big adventure. Do you remember this?
I didn't either. Don't worry. I was completely lost. I'm the host.
I mean, I know that Letty has an elevator, but I did not connect the museum elevator to the one at her house. I didn't even realise they were back until Dee asked her mum about it. There are a few other things as well. So the elevator, yeah, like we talked about that. I think
don't have an explanation for it. Like,
it's like magic. It's that idea of like,
it's just magic.
Other dimensions. And we get a mention of doorways in this episode, right? Like, even William says, yeah, we can create doorways. And I
didn't think there were actual doorways. I thought it was just a metaphor.
No, I think it's physical doorways. And then also says, Montrose better had a good reason for killing Yhema. Why the heck?
He doesn't.
I can't wait to hear what you all think. Don't think we've got a reason for that yet.
No. Pending.
Okay, this one from next email up is from John Foster Bay. I want to say how much I enjoy your discussion and banter about Lovecraft Country. My comments are going to be a bit of a stream of consciousness, so please excuse me. However, as a 71-year-old black man who grew up during the period portrayed in the show, I find your forays into race to be a bit shallow and influenced, I would even say suffering, too much from the current ahistorical definitions of systematic racism and critical race theory. So this is an interesting email because obviously, John lived through the time. So, I mean, you know, it's fascinating for us to hear from people who are living through the time portrayed in the show, right?
Also,
I mean,
fascinating invaluable. To know that we have an older audience, which is
100%.
Great. Like, that's awesome.
It is awesome. So he goes on. For example, the idea that white supremacy is a unique aberration is historically false. All over the world, all throughout history, the technologically and militarily superior cultures have dominated their less advanced neighbours, long being before the Europeans arrived in America. The Inca and the Aztecs dominated and conquered less advanced tribes and ethnic groups. And in all these situations, the rule was anything but benevolent. As a black man, the key thing I take away from about America is the extraordinary amount of racial, social change and progress over our history. I grew up during the de jure and the de facto racial segregation of the period shown. I know that actual conditions for black people were much more nuanced than the narrative being told by our current crop of anti-racism and social justice warriors. Indeed, the amount of racial progress made is astonishing by any measure. I again want to say how much I enjoy your podcast, even if I do sometimes disagree with your interpretation of race. Okay, what do you think about that, guys?
Well,
super interesting.
I mean, you can't argue with
it.
Can't argue with that.
It's such a a valuable insight and perspective that obviously we don't have. And so, you know, without sort of wanting to get defensive, because I think that was a really a lovely email, and it was very sort of respectful and understanding, I think. But I think that is the point, is that we don't have that insight. We didn't live through it. None of us grew up in America, and I think even lots of people who did grow up in America don't have that understanding of the history of racism in mm-hmm. the country. Lots do, of course, but lots don't. And you know, we openly admit that we are learning as we go along.
Learning, yeah.
And it's emails like that that help us to learn.
Yeah, 100%.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's such a valuable email, John. And I know we've had a little dialogue on email, and just to say that we really do appreciate your support. I know you like the podcast, which is great.
Thanks for taking the time to,
and as I said,
to email us and to open that dialogue.
Thanks for taking the time to send. Yeah, because that is such valuable insight. And it, like I said, like Gaz said, we only know from our perspective. Like we read the news. Obviously, we dig deeper than just the news. We read so many different articles. We try and make our own informed decisions on things. But you know, a perspective like yours is so valuable because it was at the time and relates so clearly to the show. So it's so valuable. So thank you very much,
amazing.
John.
Amazing, thank you, John.
And let us know if you pick up on anything else, because we'd love to hear more from you. Next up, an email from George Jones. Thanks for writing in, George. Hello there. After hearing the last podcast, I just wanted to shoot a little support your way. I'm a brown guy who grew up in the Bronx, so while I'm steeped in a lot of the topics and issues that are touched on in the show, I do appreciate hearing each of your perspectives on things, missing things here and there, or requiring more context to completely express it on a podcast is completely understandable. I wouldn't hold that against anyone who seems to be honestly coming to the topics with respect and an open mind. I'm sure some people have valid complaints. I respect those who may disagree with me. I just wanted to let you know that you're doing a good job balancing the content of the show that seems to shift tone from super duper serious to straight up wonky. Maybe that kind of shifting is more palatable in a television format for some than a podcast. Yeah, it is difficult to cover this show, isn't it, when it's kind of all over the place at times. makes it a challenge. I have to say, this is probably the most challenging show we've ever covered.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, 100%.
I think it's,
although
it's
season two of Westworld
just in terms of
did nearly break my brain, so
that was the challenge. Yeah.
At least this is enjoyable to watch.
I think we've all,
you missed the last season.
Well, yeah,
you missed season three of Westworld.
Yeah,
I think
we did.
We've all got our own personal shows that we've covered where it's been very difficult. And I think this show is difficult for a good reason. I think it's difficult because it's challenging us on a daily basis, to be honest with you. It's challenging me on a daily basis anyway. Right, next up, we have an email from Cecily. Hi guys, I'm a fan of your show. I enjoy listening to all of your diverse opinions about Lovecraft. However, after listening to your most recent podcast, I've noticed something that has been consistently brought up by all parties and should be discussed further. It's the expectation of horror and what it should look like. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe your idea of horror may be one-dimensional and possibly limited to your own personal experiences. By definition, horror is an intense feeling of fear, shock, or disgust. Being a 34-year-old black woman raised in Southern California, most of the imagery displayed in the show, specifically in regards to racism in America, has frightened me. To see them projected on my television screen in present day is unsettling. Or maybe it's because in the summer of 2000, when I was 11 years old, my family was accosted by a white sheriff while passing through a small sundown town en route to Savannah, GA. I'll never forget those evil, piercing blue eyes and threatening words he spoke to my father while his son, no older than myself at the time, sat in the front seat of the police car. I'll never forget the fear his horrible English and strong Southern accent evoked in my father, a man who is 6'3", barely educated, and had been fearless up until that moment. I will never forget the fear and sadness I felt. Maybe it's because as I watched, I knew if Atticus misspoke, it would have cost him his life. I saw the same fear and caution in Atticus as I did in my dad. While I'm also a fan of blood, gore, and monsters, please note that they do not have to be present in order to evoke fear, and I hope my insight helps you guys.
Yeah,
thank
absolutely.
You very much for that email, Cecily. That is, you know, once again, valuable because it's personal. It's an account of something that you've experienced that has been echoed in the show. And of course, if we haven't said it, and if you don't think we've said it, you know, the tagline of the book is "The Real Monsters of America." That is the tagline.
I don't think we've mentioned that actually, Len. That's really worth mentioning.
I think we did mention it in the preview podcast to the season because we did discuss the book in more detail. And I guess for me and Emma, I think what might happen is we don't gloss over it, but we've read the book, we watched the show, we know that tagline, we know that the real end, you know, the real monsters of the show is racism, and it's this conversation about race. Maybe we haven't articulated that well enough during the show because we are trying to once again balance this interesting blend of horror and real horror, you know what I mean, and also criticize, you know, being critical of the show, the way it's telling those stories, is it doing it in the most effective manner. It's a difficult balancing act, right? So I think that email is very, very
can I just say with that email, see, this is probably an example of how our listeners can help us. The thought of there being a sundown town, like in the year 2000.
I mean, that's it was in quotation marks because it's obviously an area that used to be a sundown town or had a sundown town.
But the fact that fear even exists is horrifying.
Yeah. Yeah. So obviously it's not like a legal thing, but it's not sort of officially designated a sundown town, but in all practical ways it is. That's it's pretty incredible. Shocking to hear.
Shocking stuff. But as I said, these emails are fantastic because I'm sure lots of people are listening to this, listeners are listening to this and learning stuff as we are as well, because we do know some things, but obviously the valuable insight we get from some people who have been through experiences that relate to the show is fantastic. That is stuff that we want to hear because it only enhances our viewing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it probably enhances a lot of our listeners' viewing as well. Next up, we have an email from Kim. She says, "Hey, I love your podcast and listening to your honest, careful and caring insights into Lovecraft Country and the other shows that you all reflect on." Thank you, Kim. "I hope you're already aware, but just in case, the official HBO podcast includes a writer from the show. She and the co-host discuss the deep and complicated racial aspects of the story and very intentional process the creator challenged the writers to go through. She commends this resource if we want to check it out." Obviously, we do listen to it. Now, what I will say about official podcasts, and I love them because they're invaluable, once again, information from what the writers were thinking when they created the show. I find very rarely they actually criticize their own show. Obviously, they're never going to analyze their own show and go, "Well, did we tell that the correct way?" Very rarely do they do that. And what we do here at Fan Critical is, as I said, we balance everything. We are not just looking at the social commentary. We are also looking at this as a piece of art, a piece of television. Is it delivering that message in the correct manner? Could they have done something better? Was this character sidelined, like Yahima, for example?
They know exactly the point they're trying to get across, and sometimes it's not that easy as a fan or a viewer to get that. So definitely interesting.
They're saying, yeah, it's the same with all official podcasts. I love them. I listen to them. Such valuable insight. They're telling you what they're trying to get across. But did it come across that way? You know what I mean? Like, if you watched the episode and didn't have their insight, did it come across that way? And that's what we try and do here. We try and analyze the show, rate it fairly, as we do with our patented blueberry scale. Of course, we listen to it. Please, everyone, do listen to it. I think that will definitely go into a lot more of the social commentary than the actual construction of the show, whereas we try and do a bit of both, if you get what I mean. Plus Cthulhu Corner, you know, that's ours. That's patented, Cthulhu Corner, so check that out. And next up, and finally, an email from Tara. Firstly, Ruby as Hilary Davenport was wearing the face of the Del Dog woman from episode 2 who was guarding the tower.
Yeah, we didn't
mention
this.
Now, we didn't actually talk about this. I did sort of mention it in passing, then I think we forgot.
We know
about
who
it.
She is, and then we never mentioned back. It again.
Oh, we know who she is.
Never to be mentioned.
It was weird. It was weird to me that we went back to her, because in my mind, and Emma in the book, she's a much more, like, she's a redhead. Hillary is a redhead, sort of quite very attractive woman, like, essentially.
Whereas Hillary in the show is a bit sort of more, I don't want to say run of the mill, but
she
not
doesn't stand
like
out, though,
striking and stand out kind of thing.
Yeah.
And also, I'll be honest, I had to go back and check because I wasn't sure that was who she was. It didn't immediately click to me.
Tara goes on to say, I will have to go back and rewatch, but I'm pretty sure she was killed. So I'm assuming that the real William was also killed by the police captain. I wonder if the potion / spell was created by the real William or Christina. It's possible there are other characters who are not who they appear to
good
be.
Good point, Tara.
The storyline of Montrose and his love... Very good point. The storyline of Montrose and his lover just misses the time period of McCarthyism and is a bit too early for the Stonewall riots. But I do feel both of those elements are related to the civil rights undertones of the show. Good point. McCarthyism was the early 50s, I believe. But
Stonewall was 70s.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Lastly, while HBO does get a lot of flack for their gratuitous use of sex, I think this episode highlights how much sex / relationships can be different. Ruby and William's bath scene seems manipulative / transactional, and Tick / Letty's is honest / vulnerable. Tick and Letty affirm their commitment to each other before they have sex, while Montrose barely acknowledged his lover before the act. You have the creepy store manager that sexually assaults Tamara, and then Hillary / Ruby brutally attacking him. Interesting points.
Yep. Yeah, very.
Thanks, Tara.
That is very good, Tara. I didn't really look at the sensuality of these relationships and how they're all different, and they are all different. And that has brought that to light to us. So thanks very much, Tara. I'll definitely be interested to check more of that out next week and in the coming weeks, for sure. And that's it for feedback this week. A lot of feedback. If you want to send us feedback, all you've got to do is email fancriticalpodcast@gmail.com. That is fancriticalpodcast@gmail.com. The email will be in the show notes, so you can also just do it that way. As I said, love hearing from you all. Such a varied amount of experiences and takes on the show and takes on the issues, the social commentary in the show. We love discussing it. So please do send us your thoughts. And that's it, Em. Back to you in the studio.
Thanks, Len. And thank you to everybody who has written into us this week. Amazingly varied and educational and insightful feedback that I really appreciate. We've had a really long podcast today. We talked about some really great stuff, I think, and I've really enjoyed it. And I'm looking forward to having a week off. So I am moving house next week. Len will be taking over hosting the podcast for you, and I can't wait to listen to it. Yeah,
here we go.
Watch
Chaos
out.
Chaos descends.
Watch out, guys.
Emma, what's happening is you're taking a little potion and metamorphosizing into me.
No, I don't want to. I don't want to.
And then the next week I'll just rip me off and you'll be there again.
Well, I don't want to rip anyone off physically or metaphorically. But thank you, everybody, for joining me today. I will see you in 2 weeks, and the rest of this lot will see you next week. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
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 Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.